Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, ranked in the top 20 among national public universities in the latest U.S. News & World Report. FSU specialty license plates support scholarships for deserving students. More on FSU specialty plates is at fsu.edu/mytag. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A bill called Reducing Fetal and Infant Mortality would ban most Florida abortions after 15 weeks, but some say it's focused on the wrong priorities.
For them to title this bill that way was a huge slap in the face.
Also tonight, a bipartisan Senate committee has cleared the way for two electoral maps to get to a floor vote, but some voting rights advocates warn the maps might not fully reflect the state's demographic changes.
The Florida's legislature's proposed maps ignore dramatic Latino population growth after the last decade.
We'll also sit down with one of the Florida Capitol's most experienced reporters to get his take on the session's early days. It's the end of week one in the 2022 Florida lawmaking session. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. A new bill in the Florida legislature would ban most abortions after 15 weeks. Regan McCarthy reports the measure hasn't yet had a committee hearing, but already advocates and lawmakers are lining up to fight for their side of the issue.
They titled it Reducing Fetal and Infant Mortality.
That's Jacksonville Democratic Representative Angie Nixon.
When I saw that, I got pissed. You want to know why I got pissed? Because I am a Black mom, right? I am a Black woman. I just had a baby less than 2 years ago, and I realized the risk that Black women have, right? Especially our babies. We suffer from infant mortality 2.3 times more than white babies. And for them to title this bill that way was a huge slap in the face.
Nixon says the bill title is misleading. She says if lawmakers want to address infant mortality in Florida, she has some other ideas.
You know, if they really want to reduce infant mortality, what they can do is start trusting and believing in Black women when they say they don't feel good when they're going to the doctor, right? What they can do is instead of just putting out all these monies and incentives for law enforcement officers to come from out of the state, they can make sure that they are incentivizing more Black doctors. That's what they should be doing. So I'm a little perturbed by what's going on and transpiring here in the state house.
Republicans Representative Aaron Grawl and Senator Kelly Stargell are behind the measure. Stargell has long been a supporter of legislation that reduces access to abortions. She says for her, it's personal. She was 17 when she found out she was pregnant. She's told her story many times on the Senate floor.
I did not want to tell my mother that I was pregnant. Probably the hardest conversation I've ever had with anybody in my life. But I'm so glad I did.
Stargell says she believes life begins at conception. The measure, which prohibits most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy, largely mirrors the abortion restriction in a Mississippi law that is before the U.S. Supreme Court and is widely expected to be upheld. Republicans are hopeful that outcome could pave the way for a change in Florida, where a right to privacy clause in the state constitution has been used to limit abortion restriction before fetal viability. John Stimberger is president of the Florida Family Policy Council, an organization that supports greater abortion regulation. He says the new, more conservative makeup of Florida's Supreme Court could also eventually play a role. He believes there's a chance the state Supreme Court could find the privacy clause does not relate to abortion.
We now have a very clear-thinking, textualist constitution, Florida Supreme Court, and I think that if there is a bill and it's challenged and brought before them, I think that they'll make a correct decision in realizing this was never intended to confer a right to abortion.
Meanwhile, lawmakers and advocates say while a Texas-style abortion bill that prohibits most abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected and allows citizen enforcement through civil suits has been filed in the state, they agree it's unlikely to get traction during this legislative session. I'm Regan McCarthy.
The Florida Senate's state and congressional electoral maps are moving to a floor vote. As Valerie Crowder reports, voting rights advocates argue lawmakers failed to fully account for the state's population growth, particularly when it comes to Hispanic voters.
The Senate's congressional plan includes 4 African American districts and 4 Hispanic districts, meeting the state Supreme Court's benchmarks from 2015. But the state has experienced significant population growth over the last decade, so much that the state added a 28th congressional district. Lawmakers, however, only analyzed the demographics in districts that the court identified as majority-minority districts. Florida League of Women Voters President Cecile Schoon says they should have looked beyond those districts.
They're seemingly saying, we did a functional analysis, we checked on this protected district that was determined by the Florida Supreme Court, and they don't seem to be looking at all to see if there's any other opportunities for minorities to select representatives of their choice. And with all the change in population, it doesn't make sense that they would rely only on protecting the districts that were established in 2015 based on 2010 census.
As part of the state constitution's Fair Districts Amendments, the state's electoral maps must meet a 2-tier requirement. Tier 1 prohibits intentional partisan gerrymandering and requires districts to ensure racial and language minority groups have an equal opportunity to elect candidates of their choice and participate in the political process. Tier 2 standards require that the maps are compact and follow existing political and geographic boundaries, including highways, rivers, and city and county lines. Tier 1 trumps Tier 2. Schoon says the maps were drawn to meet the lesser requirement and then adjusted to meet the higher standards.
So they drew the maps by telling their staff, we want you to build the maps based on Tier 2. Tier 2 is not mandatory. It's the stuff that gives way to Tier 1. So everything you do has to be checked to make sure it's not violating Tier 1, and you're only checking the benchmarks. How are you being sure that Tier 1's not violated in many more districts?
Schoon says public input in the remapping process has been limited. Lawmakers refused to hold town hall meetings across the state to gather public input on the maps, citing concerns about COVID-19. Instead, opportunities for residents to weigh in were limited to speaking at committee hearings and submitting suggestions in draft maps online. Stephen Manguel is with the Latino Justice Coalition. He recently told the Senate committee that Hispanic voters face language barriers due to the absence of translators at committee meetings and the absence of a bilingual state redistricting website.
The process has been inaccessible for public comment by limited English proficient Floridians and the many members of the public impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. The end result has been the dilution of Latino political power.
U.S. Census data shows since 2010, the state's Latino population has grown by more than a third, with 1.4 million Latino residents calling the state home. Manguel explained there should be more language majority-minority districts to account for this growth.
Latino Floridians must have an equal opportunity to elect their candidates of choice and remain politically unified in communities of interest. The Florida's legislature's proposed maps ignore dramatic Latino population growth after the last decade.
Republican redistricting leaders say the process they've employed has generated maps that meet all state and federal requirements. Still, they say they expect legal challenges to the maps when they're approved. After the Senate approves its district, State Attorney General Ashley Moody has 15 days to review the map before it heads to the state Supreme Court. The court has 30 days to give the map the green light. As for the congressional map, the Senate and House must come to an agreement on a plan. After they pass a congressional map, it heads to Governor Ron DeSantis. The goal is to finish the maps well ahead of the candidate qualifying period in mid-June. I'm Valerie Crowder.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a veteran Capitol reporter gives his take on the session's initial week.
Florida is not going to follow, most conventional healthcare guidelines when it comes to trying to fight this pandemic. So We're going to have a pandemic for quite a while, it looks like.
And a leader in the Florida LGBTQ community was found dead last week in a Jackson County landfill. The Tallahassee Police Department is now looking into his death as a homicide. On Capitol Report from the Gannett Bureau in Tallahassee, John Kennedy joins us here with a look back over the first week. It seems like months, but it's only week one of the Florida lawmaking session that just wrapped up. John, first of all, Happy New Year to you and yours, and just any basic impressions that you have coming off of this first week of session.
Well, I don't know. It seems like it's going to be a session where Governor DeSantis is in charge. Maybe that's not such a surprise when you have a Republican-dominated legislature that is pretty much, supporters and some might even say supplicants of the Florida governor, who also is a Republican, who is running for re-election this year. And as we know, he's talked of frequently as a potential White House contender in 2024. So he's certainly got a lot of attention within the Republican Party, and most of those that are in charge of the legislature are ready to do his bidding, pretty much.
A lot of bills that were priorities of the governor seem to have gained rapid traction in the first week of session, John. You have things like the 15-week and out ban on abortion. You have immigration bills that have come up. You have some local preemptions in the pipeline. A lot of things that normally might be deferred until later on in the session, but they are fresh out of the starting gate here this year.
Yeah, they are. And the abortion legislation, which would reduce the number of weeks that a legal abortion could be performed to 15 weeks from the current 24. That's a little bit of a surprise that maybe that has come out so quickly. You know, this is it's very similar to a Mississippi law that is now before the United States Supreme Court, which is not expected to rule on the constitutionality of that law until June. There was some speculation that maybe the legislature might try to, wait and see what the court would say, but that doesn't seem to be the case. It looks like they're ready to move ahead on that legislation with the feeling that the Supreme Court is going to uphold it and really put a change into the historic Roe versus Wade.
Well, speaking of the Supreme Court, John, of course, we had the ruling from that august organization that federal mandates when it comes to the private sector regarding vaccines against COVID are no longer functional. And Florida, of course, has its own kind of replicant anti-mandates in that regard, too. And yet there are a lot of organizations, I'm thinking here of public health, hospitals and nursing homes and that kind of maybe betwixt and between on all this. Do you see any kind of a compromise or any legislation addressing that seeming conflict coming down the ways anytime soon?
Yeah, I don't know. It seems as if the governor has been, very anti-vaccine mandates. He says that he is not going to try to enforce that standard on healthcare providers in the state of Florida. So, there's not a lot of guidance to the individual healthcare units that are going to have to be dealing with this, conflict that's out there right now. But just as, we had a special session back in November where the governor did push through successfully through that Republican legislature, basically a separation from the vaccine mandates that now the Supreme Court has dismissed that the Biden administration had been pushing, vaccines or testing for most major companies. So, Florida is cutting its own path. And, we heard a lot of that in the governor's State of the State speech this week. You know, he used the word free and freedom and freest a dozen times across the span of a 35-minute address to the joint session of the House and Senate. So the governor is pretty single-minded on Florida is not going to follow, most conventional healthcare guidelines when it comes to trying to fight this pandemic. So we're going to have a pandemic for quite a while, it looks like.
Yeah, and it doesn't look like the Florida legislature, in contrast to last year, when essentially the Capitol was shut down, even if the governor didn't want anything else to be shut down in the state, whether it was schools or private businesses or churches or whatever. This year, you didn't see too many masks in that joint session of the legislature on the first day of session, and it is wide open to all comers as far as lobbyists and advocates and groups that might be coming to petition lawmakers for whatever they're looking at. Is there any fear that you picked up on from staff members at the Capitol or anyone else that we may have a rough time of it if the Omicron variant takes hold and maybe endangers even some quorum calls at committee meetings?
Yeah, I mean, that's a strong possibility, it would seem. We did speak a little bit with House Speaker Sprouls this week, and he sort of reiterated that, yes, the guidance to legislators is, if you test positive, stay away for at least 5 days, isolate. And that seems to be, that advice seems to be going out somewhat casually, though, to the members.
Early days yet, John Kennedy, but any prognostications as we move forward into the, final 8 weeks of session here?
Well, I think one thing that might be a bit of a surprise is that on the topic of redistricting, which many of us thought was going to really, kind of dominate the session, and it still may, that there looks to be some speed on the part of the Senate to move forward with redistricting. It may go to the Senate floor as early as next week. The House is not moving quite as fast, but, regardless, it would seem that there's going to be some movement on redistricting, maybe a little bit quicker than anticipated. There's a lot of feeling that, they may not really button it up till the very, last days of session on which the scheduled end is March 11th.
That is true, and we'll be following it all the way through, and we know you will too. John Kennedy, thank you for your insights and expertise and background here in helping us kind of look back at the first week of session with so many more to come. John Kennedy with Tallahassee's Gannett Bureau. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you, Tom.
Florida's public universities are governed by 13-member boards of trustees. They're supposed to help the schools with developing overall missions and set strategic goals. They also approve new programs and assist with key hires. Trustees are appointed by the governor, as well as the Board of Governors, which oversees the 12 public institutions. But as Lynn Hatter has found, more than two-thirds of Florida's public universities have sitting trustees whose terms are expired, and there are no new appointments in sight. The result? That's causing problems for some schools trying to run the day-to-day business of educating students.
Tallahassee has two public universities, Florida A&M and Florida State. On FSU's board, all members are current. At FAMU, two of its members, including board chairman Kelvin Lawson, are serving beyond their terms. Lawson has found himself at the center of several issues in the past few years. The school's former vice president of advancement, George Cotton, filed a whistleblower lawsuit in 2019. He alleges Lawson and two other trustees tried to pressure him into hiring their friends at FAMU.
It was very difficult for the president to run the university. And I would argue that it still remains difficult for the president to run the university.
Cotton's case at FAMU was ongoing. During his time at the school, Cotton says FAMU's board was involved in far more than the state-mandated tasks of approving programs and helping with key hires.
They were overly involved and troublingly meddling in the day-to-day affairs of the institution. They would probe as deep into hiring of clerical staff all the way up to hiring of senior-level management.
Lawson was connected to another mishap, the transfer of $3 million from the school's auxiliary funds to its athletics department, a move that's barred by the state's public university governing board. Cotton claims Lawson pressured him to move the funds. When he refused, he says Lawson threatened his job. In 2019, Lawson appeared before the State University System Board of Governors and disclosed the transfer, calling it, quote, unacceptable. Two women, the school's comptroller and budget director, were fired. The chief financial officer resigned.
I can't talk about, because I don't know, what happens at other institutions, but I'm told that this is a similar concern. But at FAMU, not only are trustees involved in the day-to-day operation, but they insert themselves wrongfully into attempts to steal contracts, and that happened with me, to try to get friends and cronies hired, to get people fired. And when you don't do what, and in my case, when you don't do it, they threaten you.
Now several people employed by FAMU and familiar with the situation say Lawson is meddling in the school's decision over whether to retain athletics director Courtney Gaucher. During a recent board meeting, Lawson called for a vote of confidence for Gaucher, something usually not done unless a person is in danger of being fired. Lawson did not return several requests for a comment on this story. His term formally ended last January, yet he's still serving as board chairman. And he is among the more than a dozen people at seven of Florida's public universities that are still serving on their boards despite their terms being over. These positions are unpaid. FAMU is not the only institution grappling with the consequences of trustees who've overstayed their welcome. State law does not address whether trustees have to step down when their terms are up. Ben Wilcox with the Government Accountability Group, Common Cause Florida, says it's a complicated issue.
Apparently, Board of Trustee members are allowed to continue to serve after their terms have expired. I don't see that there's any kind of an end date, for the expiration of their terms.
Wilcox says he does not understand why the governor and Board of Governors don't just reappoint the trustees whose terms are up.
It's an optics problem for the most part, in that, for the public looking at this, it would raise the question of whether, they are legitimately board members if their terms have expired.
The governor's office did not respond to a request for comment regarding the status of the expired trustees. Recently, State Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried accused Governor Ron DeSantis of a pay-for-play, asking for donations in return for appointments. There's no direct evidence to support that claim, but there are many university employees across the system, professors, administrators, and staff, who are growing increasingly concerned about trustees overstepping their bounds.
It's a very short-term, bottom-line kind of thing, and the more short-term and bottom-line you become, the more top-down you become, the more army-like command structure comes into play.
Mira Sitharam is the vice president of the faculty union at the University of Florida. The university is facing several controversies related to its board chairman, Maury Hussaini. Hussaini is a supporter of DeSantis and helped fast-track the hire of State Surgeon General Joseph Latipo into a tenured faculty position. Hussaini has denied accusations he and other board members influenced UF's decision to prevent several professors from testifying as expert witnesses in a voting rights lawsuit against the state. Sitharam says leaving too many business-minded people in positions overseeing education who don't have backgrounds in the area leaves boards open to potential conflicts of interest.
To what extent, how are these people screened? So university has a, is a nonprofit. And, once it is established, all the places around it itself is a nonprofit and, is tax exempt to a large degree. And so there are lots of potential kickbacks you could be getting by establishing a university, not just contracts directly for building in the university, but also around the university.
The way university board members are appointed is fairly straightforward. There's a student and a faculty representative. The governor gets 6 appointments, and the Board of Governors names 5 members. But the Board of Governors is also appointed by the governor, allowing whoever is in that position to basically control the leaders of all 12 public universities. Sitharam believes the state should consider getting more people with more diverse backgrounds on the boards and suggests there should be term limits in place.
There's got to be term limits. So, even if you don't are not able to sort of directly pinpoint a conflict of interest in a financial sense, it could be that, you know, people, once they reach a certain age, they're just drunk with their own power. They're sitting on this board and on that board, and they boast to people, I can tell XYZ what to do.
Sitharam sees the issue as more about gaining power and influence than money. It's a situation that can easily lead to an abuse of university resources, says FAMU whistleblower George Cotton. He says very few employees speak up because they need their jobs. I'm Len Hatter.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Tallahassee resident and Florida LGBTQ leader George Diaz Johnston was found dead in a Jackson County landfill last weekend. Brett Rutherford reports the Tallahassee Police Department is investigating his death as a homicide.
Diaz Johnston and his partner were one of the six couples listed as plaintiffs in a lawsuit against the Miami-Dade County Clerk's Office that resulted in the county lifting its ban on gay marriage in 2015.
Marriage matters. It matters to us. Because sometimes all you have to hold on to is each other. When we got engaged, I gave Don my late father's wedding ring, both as a reminder to us of the serious commitment we are making to each other and a reminder that governments can and will take away one's freedoms.
Stratton Pollitzer, the Deputy Director for Equality Florida, says the Florida LGBTQ community is struggling with the news of Diaz Johnston's death.
It was shocking. You know, it was a devastating news. And the violence of it just amplifies the grief that we're feeling.
Pollitzer says George and his husband Don's contributions to the fight for marriage equality will never be forgotten.
It's a willingness to put your personal life on a very big stage. It's scary, all of the media involved. It's extremely time-consuming, and it really took tremendous courage.
Diaz Johnston was last seen on January 3rd, but a missing persons report was not filed for another 5 days, on January 8th, the day his body was found. According to the Okaloosa County Sheriff's Office, Diaz Johnston's body had, quote, been in trash collected around 9:30 a.m. at the Baker Landfill, which is located in Crestview, Florida. The body was then taken to and discovered at a Jackson County landfill. It is unclear where or when Diaz Johnston died and how his body ended up in Ogallala, then in Jackson. Diaz Johnston's brother is Manny Diaz, the chair of the Florida Democratic Party and the former mayor of Miami. In a statement, Diaz expressed appreciation for the support shown to his family and for the efforts made by the Tallahassee Police Department in their investigation. The Tallahassee Police Department has taken over the investigation and is treating it as a homicide. They intend to provide more information as it becomes available. I'm Brett Rutherford.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Valerie Crowder, Gina Jordan, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Brett Rutherford. Technical assistance for Capital Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Florida lawmakers will be taking this coming Monday off in observance of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. We'll be doing likewise, but we'll return on Tuesday, January 18th. Join us then and again each weeknight throughout the 2022 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, ranked in the top 20 among national public universities in the latest U.S. News & World Report. FSU specialty license plates support scholarships for deserving students. More on FSU specialty plates is at fsu.edu/mytag.